Welcome to Entrepreneur Showdown presents with your hosts, Joe Cassandra and Dan Franks.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. I am Dan Franks, one half of the Entrepreneur Showdown team. Coming on shortly, my partner in crime, Joe Cassandra. And today we are pumped to bring you the second episode of Entrepreneur Showdown Presents. And in this month of October, every Thursday, we'll be bringing you an interview with some entertainment entrepreneur. And today, our guest is not just some entrepreneur. Our guest is Scott Osborne from Highland Concerts. Now, Highland Concerts specializes in putting on EDM music festivals. And if you don't know what EDM is, it's electronic dance music. And Scott's group puts on one of the biggest EDM festivals in Texas every year, and really in the whole country. And the one coming up soon is called Lights All Night. And it's a two-day festival right here in Dallas, Texas, where Joe and I are from. And the difference is Scott's group, Highland Concerts, is branching out internationally. So they're one of the few United States-based groups that are going all over the world with these concerts, bringing them to places that have never had these type of festivals before. And their next one is actually New Year's Eve this year in Mexico City, which is pretty groundbreaking for this whole scene. So I don't want to waste any more time. I wanted to let Scott tell you guys his story. So just to let you know, for all the show notes of today's episode and a whole lot more, head on over to EntrepreneurShowdown.com. And now let's get on to Scott Osborne of Highland Concerts. Today's guest on Entrepreneur Showdown Presents is a young man who is producing some grown-ass results. Scott Osborne, along with his partner, Hank Keller, are co-founders of Highland Concerts, where their current focus is promoting and producing some of the biggest events on the planet. They're currently ramping up for a few of the biggest events they've ever put on, Lights All Night, in multiple cities across the world. But they've taken a break to join us on this special edition of the Showdown. So, Scott, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I got to jump to this real quick before we get into the real content. What kind of groupies are there for concert promoters?
That I don't even know. Comment.
Okay, well, we'll go ahead and say that Hank, since he's not joining us, is the one that would be able to answer that question.
Yeah, that's where he is right now.
Hank's getting married actually next Saturday.
Okay, so we'll say maybe he doesn't have experience with the groupies either.
Right.
How about that? Okay, so why don't you give us a little background then about what your company does and how you got to, I guess, being the co-founder of that company.
So Hank and I both started promoting shows and whatnot when we were in college. I ran an event at Texas Tech called Calf Fry. Hank was the head of his fraternity for all the parties and events. He was at LSU. There was an event in 2008 that Hank started with the Ole Miss UT football game going on in Texas, and it was the Cotton Bowl, and so he did a New Year's Eve event at the Fairmont, sold $200 tickets and sold about 600 total. That event, he did it in 2009, sold 1,200 tickets at another hotel. And then he called me after that year. I was going to school at the University of Montana, which has an entertainment management program up there. I was doing promotions and working in a theater and had experience from Texas Tech. And he said, hey, let's take this thing to the next level and let's, you know, get a headlining artist in there and see if we can get a brand around it and build it. And so that year I moved back to Dallas. He moved back to Dallas. And in September, we booked Ghostland Observatory in Dallas, Texas, which is an Austin-based band that was kind of like half electronic, half rock and roll, if you will, covered an ice skating rink in downtown Dallas at the Marriott Hotel and sold 6,000 tickets and sold it out before the show. And that was the first inaugural Lights All Night. From there, we then knew, you know, the whole core of the business from the beginning was understanding that in the United States, that the festival market was very unsaturated at that point and still is, and that there was a huge hole to produce those types of shows in multi-stage events. And so we used all of the momentum and all of, you know, the notoriety that the brand had from the Ghostland Observatory show of 6,000 people and decided now is the time to take this to the next level, take the financial risk, raise private equity, and really try to give this all that we can in building a brand. And especially at the same time, electronic dance music was blowing out of the seams and turning into what is now looking like a long-term mainstay genre, similar to how rap had its explosion and where it is today. So that's when in 2011, when we booked acts like Tiesto and Girl Talk and Laid Back Luke and other, you know, notably large EDM artists. And we had a great year. We went from 6,000 tickets to 26,000 tickets over 2 days. Increased revenues and everything just hand over fist. And at that point, that was kind of our entrance into the market. And from there, the event was at Fair Park last year. It was 3 days. Over the weekend, we did 38,000. And now this year, we're actually scaling it back a bit in Dallas in terms of just the days, because New Year's Eve falls on a Tuesday, but we're utilizing the weekend and again expand to all these other properties such as San Francisco and Mexico City, and then working on with several other international partners as well. So that's kind of the spiel, if you will, of how we started and where we are today.
So that's pretty impressive. You took this from a calf fry to a multi-city, multi-country event almost that's happening within the course of a few days. And we're definitely going to dig into that, but I want to go back a little bit. So when you started, when you were younger, certainly this promoting concert wasn't the first entrepreneurial venture you had your hand in. What was your first exposure to being a so-called entrepreneur?
It really was calf fry was one of the situations where that really kind of put me into a position to run things and have to make things. Things were not going to get done unless I did it or I put a team or action in place. But I think on my own with, going out and raising capital, it was in 2010 when we really went out maybe a bit before that. Like, we started doing shows. We did shows in Montana. We did club shows and theater shows, but the first, creating your own LLC, setting up, getting legal involved, setting up a management type system, a marketing plan was in 2010 when we did Ghostland Observatory. And that's was the first year of the brand.
So when you guys first started out, since I guess you both did promoting at your different schools, did you guys do, I guess because you guys were friends before college, did you guys do stuff together before you went off to college, as in event promotion and stuff like that?
No, we really didn't. And we just kind of knew what we were doing separately at the schools. And, it was kind of Hank had been doing the New Year's Eve event for 2 years. And I was working for the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee at the time in my junior year. And so I have, a financial background and was in business school. And I think he just said, hey, let's see if we can get some business structure to this. And I also know that you've got some talent relations. And so he gave me a call, and that was kind of, that day was like, hey, I've got private equity in Dallas that I think would be interested in getting into the concert space. Would you be interested in coming back and working on it? And it was kind of a no-brainer for me, just because I've always been passionate about music and live events and live music, and I saw it as a great opportunity. And the other thing I say too is, when I was in school, it was like 2008, when I walked into the business school and they said, when you get out of school, you're going to have a $75,000 a year job and blah, 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 blah. And then the joke I always tell people is 3 months later, they came in and said, hey, by the way, the economy's crashed. You're not going to have a job. You'll be lucky if you do. And that, was kind of the catalyst to where Hank and I are the type of people that it's not that we've not ever done well working under people or are in a corporate type of setting, but we just always had our own passion and vision and really knew that if we put our minds together, we could probably pull it off.
So when you heard that the first time, hey, you'll make 75,000, were you already thinking that that's the path you were going to go, or you were already kind of like, no, I wasn't going to do that anyway?
No, you know, at that time in my life, I was working for a senator. He was chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, still is, Max Baucus. And I was on the fast track to graduate school. I was going to go work in D.C. I was always passionate about international stuff. I had worked in Brazil doing some volunteer work and other stuff the summer before. So I had that passion as well. But, yeah, it was go to Washington, make connections, and, you know, go back to graduate school and that type of deal. But, you know, to be completely honest, it got to the point where it was so strenuous, you know, trying to uphold to that ideal, like, you know, I've got to make the best grades, I've got to get into the best school, and then I'll be able to get a job at a financial firm or something like that. And that was what I thought was what I needed to do, until I kind of was like, Hank called me and there's this other outlet of like, you know, you don't have to do that. There's several other, you know, so many other ways to make a living or to build something. And it just kind of all made sense. It was kind of an outlet. It was like, yeah, I want to do that. You know, I don't want to focus all my time and energy to this other idea of what I need to do.
Yeah. So a lot of the guests we have on are either online startups or they're definitely, you know, bootstrappers and they're following the lean startup mentality. But you guys actually went out and you found funding and you know, probably had to do some sales pitches and stuff to get the capital raised. Explain that process, because, you know, at CapFry, I'm guessing you weren't having to make sales pitches. But, you know, whenever Hank gave you a call and said, hey, I think I found some money in Dallas, you guys had to do some kind of pitch or something. Kind of explain that whole new process for you.
Well, so I like to think that we always have operated in what my idea of a lean startup is. We didn't go out and say, hey, I need, you know, $500,000 and we're going to lose it, and then in 2 years or something, we're going to make it back. Our entire plan was, you know, we need some upfront cash to pay for deposits. We have relationships that we can potentially use to not have to pay all the money up front. And once the show's over, you know, we'll cut net profits out and everyone makes the money type deal. So that was kind of the idea, and it ended up working out in 2010. And so, you know what it was? It was just going out and giving people a solid plan and saying, here are the statistics of the last 2 years. Here's what we think our growth model looks like, and here are the reasons why. And we were fortunate through Hank's connections and relationships and us being able to put a solid plan together that it worked. And we were able to go out and raise a six-figure investment that year and then give every investor 100% return on their investment.
So are they fully removed from it now? Is it now just you guys?
That group of investors is. We've had a different group of investors every year, some returning and some not. We're still, you know, some of our shows that we do are pretty cash intensive, so we still kind of like to spread out risk and work with investors on different shows.
Okay, now I want to talk about specifically the shows and the business operation in general. And I want to talk about the evolution from the very first thing that you guys jointly put on to where it is now. And we're going to get to the multiple shows and the international aspect in a minute. But just as far as the operations and your involvement in the company versus, you know, delegating work to employees and such like that, how has the company evolved from to where it started to where it is now?
So, you know, it's the way that where it started was Hank Keller and Scott Osborne in the back house at my parents' house doing everything. I mean, the marketing plan, every call, you know, watching every ticket sell, all the operations, all of the production, getting those things going. To today, you know, at the size that we're at, we've got some of the best independent contractors in the country, guys who do production at ACL. Our head of production does production for Tomorrow World, which is the big transplanted festival from Belgium that's going to be in Atlanta. Did Lollapalooza. Then our side operations guy who, you know, will work on anything from barricade to front gate to getting people through different stages and stuff has done. His resume involves like Coachella and the Hangout. Then we have some other partners, you know, that we work on different art aspects and things like that. So from that side of it, we found a really good way to outsource with the best people in the business that have helped grow our relationships within the talent agencies, because they know when they go to, when their artists go to play at Lights of the Night, that they're going to be taken care of from the beginning to the end, you know, from the advance work, which is making sure their flights and they're getting picked up on time and their hotel is ready. And then they come to the show and the stage, you know, they can literally walk on the stage at what their contracted set time is. And they know that the music and the sound and the lights, everything's going to be ready to go. So that's a huge deal. And that's, and they've helped us grow in that vein. Today, you know, we finally have moved out of the house. It, you know, we worked in the house for a while, for like 3 or 4 years out of the home. And then, you know, in the last couple of months, we've moved into an office. We've hired on a marketing manager. We've also got two other marketing assistants that are working with us as well. And, you know, a whole cast of interns. And then we will hire people here and there on different projects. So that's kind of the nice thing about the concert business. And what we do is that we're able to hire freelancers, if you will, on to help out with different stuff. But we've definitely grown our network and grown the people that have worked around us to where we know that, like, when we're doing these expansion models and we have more festivals that we're rolling out, that, you know, Hank and I are finally taking all the knowledge that we've learned over the last couple of years and being able to bestow it upon these other people and teach them and put them in positions to help us to continue to grow effectively.
Well, I see the videos online. There's quite a few videos that we'll link up to in the show notes of the past few years. So if you need an intern that sits on the stage and blows the smoke in the face of everybody in the front row, that looks like a good job for me. So I'll volunteer for that if you need that.
How did your parents feel about you guys working out of your house? I'm sure there were times where some arguments broke out or they were saying, why are you doing this? Why don't you just go get that $75,000 job? How did that relationship work out during that time?
You know, honestly, it was for both of Hank's parents and my parents were very supportive, to be completely honest, from the very beginning. I mean, they saw what was there, and they saw, I think, the amount of work that we put into from September to December of that first year. Just tirelessly working at night, you know, through the nights on different aspects of the show. And I think that, you know, it was such a short amount of time when they really just saw the company come back. And that's, you know, that was really the onset, like September 2010. And then the first real Lights on Night was December 10th. So then they got to see the finished product. And I think they were kind of blown away. They're like, wow, like, they don't know if they realized that that's what it was going to be. And then from then on, they've been very supportive, to be completely honest. Like, there's probably definitely been some times where they've questioned, you know, what is the viability of what they're doing, the long-term viability and things of that nature. But now that we've kind of seen it all come to fruition to where it is today, it's cool. I'm sure there was definitely a time or two where there was a conversation, you know, why are you doing this, or what is the long-term here, things like that. But you know, what's happened in our business today is the consolidation of EDM has kind of been the high note of what 2013 was in our industry. You know, they've electronic dance music this year is slated to be a $4.5 billion industry. That's huge. And there's a guy named Bob Sillerman out there who's said that he's going to do over $1 billion worth of acquisitions of electronic dance music companies, as well as festival properties. And, you know, we've already been through the buyout conversations with them. We've passed on some of the initial offers that they've had out there. We're potentially going to be partnering with them in a different vein. But now that there's been, you know, all this outlet, there's things that I didn't even foresee coming into this organization. You know, what is the buyout? What is the exit? And now it's directly in front of us. So it's a completely different time than what we would have ever thought could have happened in 2010.
Did you say no to a buyout because you think that you're going to grow more and you'll be able to sell for higher, or that's not your long-term plan?
No, I think that it's just a couple different things. I just think that at this time, you know, potentially maybe we weren't getting the valuation that we thought that we deserved. And furthermore, we still wanted to retain control because we're still at such a boom position right now that if we were to kind of, you know, relinquish that control, we really wouldn't be able to do these expansion properties. And, you know, we'd be at the mercy of an accountant in New York who has no idea about the market, which is Dallas, or no idea about, you know, these other opportunities and partners that we have for expansion, and just strictly making decisions based on bottom dollar. And so this allowed us another year to kind of, you know, go to Mexico City, go to San Francisco, create the partnerships in Asia and Australia for 2014, and then have a roadmap laid out that says, hey, here's what we've done, and here's where we're going, and you know, be able to come in to an organization and have a bit more say and a little bit more pull than, you know, we just do one big event in Dallas type of deal. Because that's who we are. We've always been internationally focused and always kind of looking at emerging markets and different markets and opportunity to get involved with internationally. And especially now, since the saturation of electronic music in Dallas or in really the United States is so heavy, we're really even aggressively looking internationally more because we want to plant the seeds in those places and then come back once it kind of dies out and the bubble bursts in the United States, if you will.
Well, just because I'm sure some listeners are interested to hear how like an investor entrepreneur relationship works, where the investor is not pushing for a buyout and then they get a quick profit on your business. They weren't pushing for that.
Well, the way that we work with investors is it's 1 year term, so we don't have any long term investors. It's per event.
Okay. So these investors, they were just expecting you guys to pretty much just pay them back whenever they can with a little bit of profit. Is that it?
Right. So Hank and I own 100% equity of the organization.
So they were just, I guess, like your loan service, I guess?
Is it like a joint venture partnership per show?
Yes.
Okay. So then I want to talk about, you mentioned the saturation in the U.S., and that it actually is a concern that I wanted to bring up with you, because I have noticed some festivals similar to yours, the similar lineups, have been canceled, multiple ones that I read about within the last month or so. Is that any kind of concern of yours as far as your events go? Or is that, obviously that's a driving force to going international, but do you have any concern about your events and the turnout for those?
No, I mean, we're in a position where, you know, we have the model down and we've seen the gamut. We've seen the ups, we've seen the downs. And so we have a really good understanding of what works and what doesn't. I mean, you know, we have a couple partners that are some of the heavy hitters in the game. And so they're of great advisement and have been mentors to us. And that's, you know, one of the mainstays of our organization is that we're always trying to surround ourselves with industry leaders and people who really have been in the game, you know, years beyond what we have, so that we can rely on their expertise and partner with them and grow. So, you know, other events that have come and gone and you know, that's always going to happen. In Dallas, we feel pretty confident of what our hold is and, you know, what our product is. So definitely not a concern today.
Well, you mentioned that you've seen the ups and downs. What are maybe one or two of your biggest, I don't want to call them failures, but biggest downs or biggest setbacks that you guys have experienced? And maybe how did you pivot to avoid letting those bring you down altogether?
I mean, we've lost money on shows. We've seen that. We've been in situations where we've had to work through financial dealings in order to kind of get to the other side, if you will. But the way that you pivot is, you know, always reverting back or always utilizing a model that you know works, you know? So it's like you go out, you try to make growth or you try to change things, and then you kind of, and if it doesn't work, you say, okay, well, let's go back to the drawing board and let's put the pieces back together. And, you know, the difference is this business is so, I wouldn't say, you know, oh, so drastically different than others, but it is a game of speculation in the sense that, you know, you're speculating what the market wants. You're speculating what's going to be big 6 months from now by talent buying 6 months ahead. You know, what is the ticket price, things like that. So there's so many things that you have to do, but it's one of those things where, you know, one of our proven models has always been like, when you're looking at talent, like who has a paid ticket history in the market, you know? How many tickets have they sold? Why are they worth putting on the lineup? Why are they worth this much money? And, you know, a big rule too is how can stretching a dollar, you know, how can I produce an event that looks like it costs, you know, millions and millions of dollars, but not pay millions and millions of dollars? So, you know, we've learned a lot over the last couple of years for sure from 2010 to now.
So when you first started out, how did you start the marketing, especially with bringing on acts to sell tickets for? How did you start off to get all the way up to like Tiesto and all them that you mentioned?
You know, what we did is we created a strategic partnership with an organization named MCP Presents out of they're out of Denver now, but they're out of Asheville. And so, you know, we had obviously a certain amount of clout with the artists, and then we went and partnered up with what was our management consultants to come on, who have relationships as well, to basically say, hey, look, you know, we're taking this to the next level. We're bringing on guys who have done events of this size and you have trusted relationships with. And that was partnering up was probably one of the ways that helped us kind of gain that clout. And then after that, you know, putting on great events and taking care of the artists. After 2011, it was just basically like, okay, the brand is built. The guys have a good reputation. The agents all talk to each other. They get a good vibe that their acts are going to be taken care of if they play our show. It's going to be good exposure for them. And so from there, you know, 2012, our lineup was massive last year. And so that gave us the opportunity to go out and work with all those different major acts.
So when you started out, when you said you built that clout with that initial partnership, was that just people you already knew beforehand, before you guys started?
We had been put in contact through a mutual friend and had talked with that organization about doing another festival in another part of the country. And then that kind of fell through. And then, you know, we had the Dallas event and decided that it was time to go out and really put work into a management group that can help us build it. You know, Hank and I didn't have the resources at that time. Just he and I to do it ourselves.
So if anyone's seen any of the videos of any of your events or any, the EDC, is that, I guess it's called EDC, right?
Yeah, Electric Daisy is similar. It's in Las Vegas, Orlando, New York, and London.
Okay, so yeah, so anyone who's seen any of those videos of your festivals or the EDC festivals know that they get pretty crazy. Do you have any, I guess, exciting or funny stories that have come out of any of your things? Because I'm sure you've seen it all.
Oh, I mean, you know, it's like I've seen crazy things. Like, I mean, you see from the costumes, from what people wear, the way people act. I mean, it's what it is an opportunity. And this is one thing, you know, it is a wild party. It's crazy. And that's what the atmosphere is. And we just did an entire branding and marketing strategy research development with the Richards Group. And, you know, one of the things that they labeled the demographic is risk takers. They're risk takers looking for an over-the-top cerebral experience that is something different than what they get every day. And I think a lot of that is, you know, there's been a lot of stress in the world in the last couple of years and kids and growing up and stuff. And this is a cool experience for them to kind of let loose and get out and do what they want, wear what they want, and kind of go crazy, if you will. But that's another thing, you know, too. There's a safety aspect that we put a huge amount of time and effort into, to protecting those kids and the events and what's going on. I mean, the crazy stuff, it's hard for me to answer that question from this, just sheerly from the standpoint that when I'm at the shows, I'm so, like, so focused here and there. I don't really get to see a lot of what's going on around the front of the house as much as I'm backstage just, like, kind of managing.
So at least you can tell us what the craziest costume you've ever seen is.
I mean, I've seen girls with pretty much barely any clothes on that if their parents caught them, they would probably never leave the house again for the rest of their lives. I mean, I've seen people in full body suits. You know, it's, you get a bit of everything at these events. There's no doubt about it.
I saw the electrical tape girl. I'll just call her that on the one of your videos on YouTube.
Yeah.
Okay, so you talked about how these people, it's kind of the, what did you say the consulting company called the audience?
The thrill seekers.
Yeah, the thrill seekers. So these thrill seekers inevitably bring more, I guess, danger or more liability to an event you throw. So is the name of the game just kind of insure up, or are there other things you guys do specifically to avoid these thrill seekers from doing anything that could hurt anyone around them?
You know, it's you know, there's obviously in the world of events, and especially after the collapse of the stage in Indiana, I think it was about two or three summers ago, the insurance game has changed drastically. Things in the past where contractors were coming on site and doing work where maybe they weren't signing insurance waivers, or you were bringing employees on and not either putting them under payroll under your own insurance, are things that are now 100% things that we do. We, we make sure to protect ourselves from every aspect. From the show standpoint, the patrons, the life safety aspect, that's one thing that from day one we've put a huge amount of emphasis in. And I would go as far to say that there's, and I know this from just talking with the lieutenants and chief of police in Dallas, that there's been other cities that have come and basically sought advice on how to run these events effectively and efficiently and safely. So there is, you know, it's an event, it's a concert. You get a 20,000 person city on any night of the week. You never know what one of its citizens is going to do type of deal. And so we're very adamant about substance abuse and protecting kids from that type of atmosphere, whether it be through, you know, all the police that we have, the searches, the wanding, things like that, and then on site with our medical programs and everything. You know, there's obviously a percentage of kids within this demographic that go out and go party to excess. You know, it's unfortunate that that small percentage has really kind of put a stain or a cloud, if you will, over what the environment is as a whole and what the producers do to produce safe events. But it's just, you know, what we're kind of dealing with at this point. But we've had a really high success rate of very low incidences and really no problems at all with patrons in the past with anything in that area. But it's definitely, it's a concern. It's something that's on the forefront of our mind on every event that we do.
Do you ever feel, I guess, like a moral pull on your conscience for, okay, like the girl that you see is not wearing any clothes that her parents may not even know she's here? Are you ever thinking, hey, I'm the reason that that's going to happen or anything like that?
You know, don't get me wrong. I am definitely, you know, I'm a religious person. I'm a person that I hold myself to high moral standards and things of that nature. But I'm also a person that's a little liberal in the mindset that, you know, we've set a parameter and we've said it's 18 years old, and 18 year old plus kids are adults and they can make decisions as they want to. And for me to tell that girl or that guy or whatever that they can't do that, it's, in my opinion, it's not my place. And so what I do is we create an experience that allows kids to kind of come and express themselves however it may be, whether I agree with it or I think it's right or wrong. I'm not going to be the person that makes that judgment. And we try to make it safe for them so they can do what they want. So no, I mean, I don't get my heartstrings attached or my moral strings attached to those types of things. You know, more or less the things that would concern me are the safety of kids. And if anyone got hurt at the event, or, you know, if anything happened, then those are things that would be more pressing upon me than something like that.
What about the, I guess, the main performers like Tiesto or anything like, or any of them? Do you have to, I guess, coach them in any way? Like, okay, you can't do this, or don't say that, or anything in that ballpark?
No, that's just not how it works. You know, it's when you bring talent to an event and you're basically asking them to come play your event, they, you know, they do what they're artists and they do what they want to do. And you don't have really a choice as a producer of what they do on stage or what they say or what they don't say. So you kind of have to choose wisely based on artist reputation, if they're going to be a good fit for your event. And if you feel as though, they're going to shed good light on what you're doing.
Have you ever had an experience where one of your talent kind of did something they weren't supposed to and there was a problem, or just was a pain in the ass?
No, I mean, artists are artists, and artists have large teams. They've got management teams, you know, they've got a lawyer, they've got a record label, they've got an agent. There's a lot of people involved within what an artist does. And so to say there's a particular artist out there that I have a problem with or created a problem with this wouldn't be fair, because there's always a compromise at some level with all of these different people. And so really it's just getting a team in place that's dealt with their management and dealt with their agents that can say, hey, you know, we know what they want. We've already gone through this before. And we just try to hit it on the front end and not create any type of strife with them and make it as easy for them as possible. Cause that's what it comes down to at the end of the day. It's like, we want them to have a great time. We want them to promote on their social media channels, and we want them to come back to the event again later on down the road, or go play the event that we do in some of the other locations.
You see what Joe and I are trying to do here, right? We're trying to get some juicy details, but you're very professional. We can see why you've made it to the point you have now. Okay, so you mentioned a little about social networks and how you like the, you know, give the artists a good experience so that they'll promote future events that they participate in with you. But I want to know how you guys have used new media to promote your events, especially now that you're kind of breaking new ground in places that you haven't ever run events before. How are you using new media, meaning, you know, social media, blogs, podcasts, anything like that, to get the word out about these upcoming events?
You know, it's just, it's fun is what it is at the end of the day. Is social media is one of those things that's always evolving. Obviously, Facebook has been a benchmark from the beginning. We're now seeing a lot, you know, Instagram is huge this year. I think we're seeing a lot less activity on Facebook almost. I mean, it's still there. The database is huge, so you can't discount it by any means. But you're seeing a lot of users use Instagram and Snapchat and Vine and Tumblr and things like that that we're starting to move into and create campaigns through. I think that the biggest thing for us this year, one of the strategies is really involving the community. There is a huge community around it, especially a viral online community. And so this year, in order to kind of grow into these other markets, we're really focusing on how do we get the local communities involved, not only on the street level, but digitally, as well as at the event itself. So that's a huge thing this year. Crowdsourcing and things like that is going to be a big thing in 2013 of pooling together, you know, different resources and groups. That's, you know, that's the name of the game at the end of the day, is this brand and these brands are online and these kids are online and that's where they're consuming media. They're not necessarily reading the Dallas Observer every day or the Dallas Morning News or watching, you know, TV from primetime TV from 8 to 11 because they're working jobs or things like that. They're on their iPhone or their smartphone and they're on the internet and that's where they're consuming. So finding ways to get in front of their face is always a new challenge. There's always obviously, you know, certain ways to do it and certain ways that you just marketing ideas that work. And then you kind of learn like we're always changing every year in what we do and trying to reach the audience. So social media is definitely huge and it's not going anywhere.
Okay, so we've made reference multiple times to these growing these shows to different places and different locations, and your big thing coming up right now is this December you've got a show in a 2-day show in Dallas, and then a few days after that you have one in Mexico City. So I guess in these five or six days, how is this affecting the way you guys are operating the business? Obviously, you can't be in two places at once. So is there a segregation of duties that you didn't have to worry about before, or just kind of logistically, what are all the changes you're going to have to go through to do this?
So the reason those are coming to light is simply because of the relationships that we've created. So we have partners in those markets who are the best partners in those markets. And they are the ones that are going to be dealing with all of the on-site, all the logistical issues and actually producing the show. What the relationship and partnerships that we have with them is that we're providing the content, a lot of the overarching marketing strategies and broad stroke ideas, the implementation of those ideas and strategies, and then they're kind of pushing through their channels and pushing the channels that we've created. So we've set ourselves up to where we haven't spread ourselves too thin, which is the most important part when you're expanding, I think, is, you know, you want to do it. And I think the idea is, especially if you've built something like we have, is like, well, you know, if it's huge here, it's going to be huge everywhere. But that's not the case. And you've got to always look at things from a year one standpoint. And the majority of year one standpoints in a lot of companies and organizations is at a loss. So you have to be able to say, can I go into this year one situation and sustain a loss? Do I think that loss is going to be have a return on investment within 2 to 3 years? And then you make a decision based on that. And so our decisions have been to mitigate as much risk as possible rather than holding on to 100% of the shows and trying to keep all the pie for ourselves. We're trying to slice out some for others in order to mitigate risk, but help grow faster than we would have if we would have done it on our own.
So which of your ideas, like when you want to go to Mexico City, is there a bunch of arenas that you look at and you just try and ask around to see which one's the best, or do you just have to know people in that that city, or how does that work when you when you're expanding to those cities?
When the specifically, you know, in the past we've gone to South America and we've been through Colombia and Brazil and Chile and Argentina and all those places, and we've actually done the actual site visits and gone and checked those places out. The way the Mexico City deal worked out was we knew a promoter down there, and we basically had a conversation. They sought us out, flew up from Monterrey, came and met in person. We were going to do an original deal. It didn't work out. And then we reached back out to them and said, hey, look, we're looking to expand Lights All Night. Is there any opportunities available to you for C? And that was immediately where they said, you know, we've got this venue and we're very interested and we want to do this, this, and this. And then from there, you know, you kind of lay out the framework of how is the deal going to work and then go to contract and try to put something out on paper that's going to make both sides happy. But there's always different, like we've gone to, we went to Australia last year and we went to Sydney and to Melbourne and we went on site visits. And, you know, that's one way to do it for sure. And then sometimes you get fortunate and you've got a heavyweight promoter who has the venue already sealed and locked down and knows where to go and knows how to do it. And being able to have the brand is advantageous for us because we can create partnerships, licensing deals. There's all sorts of things that we're able to do right now. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that we have so much awesome content and good feedback from artists and from fans alike in Dallas that really help boost the campaigns to expand in these other markets and make it make sense.
How often are you getting rejected by certain arenas that you wanted to get into versus the ones that said, okay, sure, we want to help you guys out and you can come here and do that?
You know, at this point, we've been fortunate to have enough references and relationships that we've never gone somewhere and said, hey, we want to do something, and they say no. It's usually, if it's not going to work out, it's because of a scheduling conflict or a timing conflict. You know, it's not, there hasn't been any other reason at this point within our organization that we've been turned down by a venue to go work at.
So for these people, before you make the trip to South America, what are you doing before you even get on the plane to go see where you're going to put on the event?
I'm networking and figuring out who the right people to know down there and then contacting them and then setting up initial plans and conversations. Sometimes, you know, before we'll go set up a deal, we'll even create a deal point memo with that organization just to make sure that they know that, you know, we're coming down, we mean business, and this is the way that we want our deal struck, and we're not going to negotiate it on their soil. Like, we're going to get it done beforehand and then go down there and do the research and discovery and hopefully move past the deal point memo into contract.
Okay, very cool. Now, you guys have these plans for 2013, and then from our discussions earlier, you have these plans to expand even more in 2014. But it still seems like, as far as concert promoters go, your actually quantity is not that much. So are your revenues, I guess your net revenues, so good on these few events that you're putting on that there's no need to really worry about a lot of smaller ones throughout, I guess, in between?
You know, it's the festival game is one of those things that if it works, it works. And we've been able to make it work. And so I could very well go and start doing club shows and things like that. But if you really look at the model of what the club show market is, it's a risky game. It's all a risky game. Don't get me wrong, but it seems to be a bit riskier sometimes unless you just have a huge amount of volume. You know, unless I was going out and buying 5-day tours on some of these acts and really spreading it out, it doesn't make a lot of sense. So what we've done is we've decided that we're going to put the last 2 or 3 years, we put all of our time and effort into Lights All Night and to get it to this point. And it's fortunately seemed to have paid off at this point to where we're in a good position where we can start, you know, working with another organization, potentially, you know, selling part of the organization and teaming up with resources. So that's kind of the answer. Like, it's one of those, if it's not broke, don't fix it thing. And we've been in a good position and we still are. And so I haven't wanted to kind of spread ourselves thin and just go out and do all the club bookings and things like that. But that being said, there's a lot of other stuff that we're kind of venturing into at this point, being like private events, trying to do stuff like that in Dallas. And then, you know, we'll do shows every once in a while for sure with partners.
So before we wrap up, I want to kind of get into a little bit of your mindset with these. When you're doing all these events, even this 2013, is there just a huge drop off after, like, you know, January 1st? Obviously, you're worn out and you want to relax, but is there almost like a, I don't know, are you almost depressed at that because you've got nothing in the forefront, you know, immediately your big thing just happened and now you have to wait another year before anything else happens?
You know, I'll definitely say not depressed. when January 1 hits in the last 3 years has been pretty awesome. It's just like the work that goes into these things, especially when you're an organization of our size and we're putting 90% of the work and effort into planning, doing stuff, is exhausting. The last 2 or 3 years, because we had put so much time and effort into Lights All Night, yeah, there's definitely that lull where there's like a month or two or three where nothing's really happening and you're just kind of like, it's kind of the shut up and wait game. You're going back into a contract with the venue or you're thinking of new ideas and stuff. But, you know, this year we've got a couple other things lined up for 2014 that I think are going to make it different than other years. But yeah, there was definitely some times in the last 2 or 3 years where it's like, okay, you know, our big event is over and we can start planning for it now, but it's 9 months away. We really be doing, and you know, you always find there is, believe it or not, always stuff to be doing. This is a 12 month out of the year event. I mean, it truly is. And so, you know, is there as much work as there is 4 months before the event? No. But there's always things that you've got to do and get in line and partnerships and things just kind of lined up for the upcoming year.
How many hours a day are you working?
I mean, my hours will vary from, I mean, it's usually sometimes 10 to 16 hours a day, if not more, just depending on what time of the year it is or what I'm doing. You know, talent buying is a pretty, I do all the talent buying, so that's a tedious job. That's negotiations that can go well into the night sometimes between agencies. And then when you're up before the event, you know, a couple weeks before the event, just getting everything in line, those are really intensive, like, easily 16 hour days throughout the weeks.
So very glamorous, right?
Yeah, that's the thing. Everyone's always like, it's like, dude, like, this is sick. Like, you have a couple stages and some big acts. Like, how hard could this be? And it's just like, it's so much more involved to where it's like, you know, we're still at the point where we're running around with the walkie-talkies and running the event. You know, we're not standing side stage popping bottles of champagne and doing that. You know, there's, and I don't know, you know, there are those promoters and there are those people that do that and they do it to be seen, see and be seen, and that's a big part of the culture of what they want in their lifestyle and stuff. But for Hank and myself, it's never really been about that. It's just been about producing awesome events and creating times for, you know, great times for tons of kids and people, and to kind of see the fruits of labor. Like, you know, you enjoy it when you're at other people's festivals, when you're able to go to other festivals and have conversations with people in the industry and catch up and talk about it. It's kind of where it really pays off at the end of the day.
Are there any times after like a 16 hour day where you feel, I guess, like some regrets for even starting this type of venture?
No,
never.
No, not at all. I mean, there's definitely been times where, I mean, don't get me wrong, there's bad days and it gets tough. But the one thing that I always stand by, and I think Hank will stand by too, is that the good days always outweigh the bad. That's just simply how it is. And, you know, it's all those old adages like if it was easy, everyone would do it and things like that. But it truly is. It's rewarding. You know, when things end up working out and you see a vision and plan that you put in place, you know, 3 years ago come to fruition to what it is, it's awesome. It's really cool and exciting to know that, you know, just out of school that we were able to do something like that and are, you know, hopeful that we can replicate this model and ideas and into other things throughout the future.
So Scott, you're well vested in this entrepreneur business owner game by now. What's the one biggest misconception that you might have had prior to becoming a full-time entrepreneur that you've learned up to this point?
I think probably the biggest, one of the misconceptions potentially would have been that I thought that being your own boss would potentially mean less stress, or I don't know if less work is the right thing to say, or just more freedom sometimes to do things, right? You think, well, if I'm my own boss, you know, I can do this or I can do that. And it's just not the case. Like, being your own boss and being the person that has to make the ends meet, being both of Hank and myself as co-founders, you know, the success of the organization lies solely on our shoulders. So there have definitely been some times where I've been at a stress point where it's like, man, should I have just gone and gotten the whatever job I could have gotten out of school and, you know, worked on someone else's money and not worried about investors and not worried about artists and not worried about all of these things around me. And then at the end of the day, you know, myself and making money and how am I going to pay for my lifestyle? But at the end of the day, you know, when even when you see the low times and then you see the high times or whatever, just being able to sustain on your own and do something that you wake up every day and have are excited about and passionate about and see the growth, make it worth it. But it's not easy. Nothing's easy. But being an entrepreneur, you definitely have to, you got to put yourself out there for sure. There's no doubt about it.
Well, that's awesome, Scott. It definitely sounds like some exciting times. Now, anyone that wants to go learn more about your company, you personally, and your upcoming events, where is the best place they can go?
www.highlandconcerts.com.
Very cool. Very easy. We'll link to that in the show notes. And like I said, we're going to link to some of the crazy videos from some of your past events. Maybe to whet some people's appetites if they're in one of the towns you're coming to. I'm going to try to see if I can talk Joe into coming out to one of the Dallas shows. I think he'd will open his senses up a little bit.
Come on, Joe.
All right, Scott. Thanks so much. We appreciate your time today.
All right. Yeah, thanks, guys. Have a great day.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you for listening to Entrepreneur Showdown Presents. Tune in every Thursday morning for another amazing interview. To hear all the past episodes and find out more, visit entrepreneurshowdown.com.